From WXXI News, it's 1370 Connection. I'm Bob Smith with our co-host for this hour, Tariq Spence of WDKX's Wake Up Club. Tariq, good to have you with us, and we're delighted to welcome our guest to the program today because the Rochester Museum and Science Center has sparked a lot of discussion in the community about issues of race and society, which its new exhibit, Race, Are We So Different? You're going to meet the woman who has served as a principal curator and really creative force for this exhibit, which came to Rochester from prior showings across this country dating back to 2008. Dr. Yolanda Moses is anthropologist and associate chancellor of the University of California at Riverside. She's going to be speaking this evening at 7:30 at Eisenhart Auditorium as part of the Science on the Edge series. And she is joining us now. And Dr. Moses, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us in advance of this evening's talk.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin, if I can, with something that's got me curious. The title of tonight's talk is Be Careful What You Wish For, The Creation of Race, Are We So Different? That almost sounds like either a warning or a retrospective regret. We all know the phrase, be careful what you wish for, because you might get it. So this came to pass. This was something that was in your mind that became reality. Any regrets or just a feeling of satisfaction and gratification putting these issues and this knowledge out there for people to see?
No regrets.
That's good.
It was a way to draw people in the title, which, you know, you have to do marketing. But the reality is this is a project whose time had come. It was a project that, as anthropologists, we felt we needed to do because there needed to be a comprehensive anthropological understanding of what race was and wasn't, because we felt if that was not put out there for general consumption, there would not be a way for us to move forward, because we all say we want to be a pluralistic democracy where everybody's engaged. Well, there's still a lot of structural racism in this country, and unless we understand how it got to be that way, what are the barriers to getting us where we need to be to make the changes, then it's not going to happen. So this is a public education program to talk about those issues.
Why do you think so many people are so apprehensive to get into these sort of dialogues? What is your feeling from sort of both perspectives as somebody who's talked with different people about this issue?
First of all, I think it's a deeply ingrained issue in our culture. Everybody has some ideas about it. They think they know about it, or ways that they've been raised. And I think because we're a highly racialized country, still, regardless of what some people say, we live in a post-racial society. Of course, we don't. I think people, even well-meaning people, don't understand how to talk about it. Mm. That is, we know how racist people who believe in natural differences among people talk about it. But how do intellectuals or enlightened people or people who want to move the conversation talk about it without feeling that they're being racist or they're asking the wrong questions? And so what we wanted to do was to give people an opportunity to enter into this discussion from several different perspectives and not feel that they would be silenced in the conversation.
Does what we often refer to as racism today come from an essential ignorance about our own origins as a species, as Homo sapiens? Simply that because we're fighting out, we found out, we all came from one place in East Africa and spread around the globe.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the aha moments, I was in a talk earlier where I said there were like several aha moments of the exhibit. One of those aha moments was the take home that we are all Africans. That catches people's attention. But what that means is we started out from the same place biologically as Homo sapiens. And if we were to get rid of everybody on the planet and wanted to start all over again, all that genetic material is on that continent to do it all over again. And that's a very interesting thing for people to know.
There's also something that comes out of it that's kind of a logical extension of that knowledge, and that is, well, if we're all coming from the same place and we're all sharing the same essential genetic blueprint, then everything else is just cosmetics and trivia, isn't it?
Yes and no. From a purely biological perspective, yes. But from a cultural and a social perspective, no. Because what we've done as cultures and societies, particularly the U.S., is to make meaning out of those variations of humans. And for us in the United States, the focus was on skin color.
How did it get that way?
Well, a lot of it had to do with, and this is the history story, right? A lot of it had to do with European expansion from Europe to places where people looked different, spoke different, talked different, and then giving meaning to those differences and assigning ways, code ways of doing that. And when the U.S. came to America, the early settlers encountered Native Americans who were totally different than the Europeans who were coming there. And then when they brought indentured servants and slaves to the U.S., that was another mix. When the plantation economies developed, both indentured servants and blacks were working the plantations, but the indentured servants were able to sneak away and blend into the woodwork, so to speak, and then Africans couldn't. So the skin color became salient in that economy. And then there were cultural mores of who you couldn't marry. There were religious, and then science reinforced the fact that not only were these folks different, but it was a different kind of difference that created a hierarchy of people. And that's what our laws are based on, our historical laws anyway.
In a lot of cases, pseudoscience or bad science.
Bad science that we had a lot to do with as anthropologists, which is one of the reasons we wanted to undo it.
Well, I believe you're on the right path to doing it, too. And talk a little bit about the fact that just about every culture in America has had sort of some sort of feeling as if they were discriminated against. There's always been a feeling about African Americans, Latin Americans, Italian Americans,
exactly.
Every form
Southern
European. Every single form of people who have either come to this country under their family's will or against their will has felt this sort of feeling. You don't have to go that far back in generations to talk about it.
That's
all the way back to No Irish Need Apply.
Exactly.
Well, we have some colleagues who've done research on when Jews became white people, when Irish became white people, mm-hmm. because to be white in this country was defined also by laws that said who could own property, who could vote, who could do all these things. And certainly slaves were not allowed to do that. Certainly Native Americans were not allowed to do that. But as the waves of immigrants came to the United States, that racial hierarchy had been set so that anybody else who came in had to put at the bottom and then had to work their way up if they could. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're trying to get people to understand, that it's not just about how I feel about you as an individual, but it's about a structural hierarchy that is still operative, that is often invisible. Mm. And you see it periodically with things like predatory lending practices and like bank practices. Those are the kinds of structures that are still in place to keep people down. But there was a time, and it wasn't until the GI Bill, that Jews were able to do a lot of things in this country, go to college, do all those things. So they were not considered white people until then.
Wow.
263 WXXI. Mike in Rochester is on the line as we continue our conversation with Yolanda Moses.
Yeah, I wanted to make the...
Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Am I on?
You sure are.
Okay, I wanted to make the point that you said that race is an issue of color in America. And my experience is... In 1980, I went to the island of Crete, stationed with the Air Force, and there was a definite difference between the Turkish and the Greek culture, but the people looked alike. Mm-hmm. And many of the Americans didn't understand the hatred that existed between these people. And on our base, we had someone called Jimmy the Greek, who was essentially the civilian attaché connection to the military people. And the joke was on the Americans because he was actually a Turk. And people were there for 18 months and they didn't come to the point to realize that the man was actually a Turk and they were calling him Jimmy the Greek all the time. So I'm just saying, this issue of American culture is that we're so shallow, yeah, we don't look past the outside of the skin color.
And to your point, there are different ways that other people in other places and other cultures have ranked folks, and by ethnicity, by a national origin, by religion. And we tend to, our salient feature here in this culture happens to be skin color.
I think the other interesting thing is the fact that we were exposed to so many different cultures, yet we don't even ask the question of, you know, so you said before, someone is considered white, we just might say Merry Christmas and not realize they're Jewish. So,
exactly.
I mean, you know, we're not willing to go deeper into what we see.
Yes.
And that's what sort of holds us back.
Well,
I think it's a tribute to our television society. We're so much of a television society, yeah, too, that we're all visually connected. And I think that might be a problem with our culture.
I was going to say that as we become more involved in global issues and as more immigrants come to us from other parts of the world, they're pushing us to think differently about these categories because they don't make sense for people who come from other places where this has no salience at all.
I guess I do thank you very much for calling. Before we go to the next caller, which we're going to do in just a second, I guess it still, I'm sure, is confusing to a lot of people as to why these things become so important in distinguishing people who are otherwise culturally and even educationally and economically alike, and nevertheless, we can't see even that deep. This has people puzzled now to a degree that maybe it hasn't ever before.
I think the other question is the fact that how do we even bring it up? Have you ever been in a situation when somebody says, please don't take offense to this, but, and you're kind of waiting for the answer, and you're almost happy that they asked you the question because you can tell them exactly what they need to know as opposed to who else they would ask that would be offended by it. And I think that's that dangerous sort of term that we use. It don't take offense to this, but I was always wondering why fill in the blank.
Right.
You've got to be willing to answer that question from the perspective of how do you feel that question was asked to you.
Exactly.
You know,
one of the reasons we decided to do this was to correct the record. A second one is that there were conversations started by Bill Clinton back in the 90s when he was doing his tour of town hall meetings on race, but these were like one-offs. And it was just frustrating because people had so many more things they wanted to talk about, so many more issues to talk about other than that town hall meeting. And so we felt that this was a project that would give communities the data, the information that they could have these conversations. And the third thing was we pitched this toward younger audiences because what the research has shown is that the young generation, that's called Generation Next, is a generation that is willing to take on controversial issues, but they don't have the tools to do it. Mm-hmm. So they will talk about it. They will talk about it with each other. And so we felt we wanted to give these tools to teachers, to young people. And so we pitched it to teachers and kids. And what we found is that there are a lot of other people who are interested in it as well.
When we talk about questions that people have and that they want to ask or that they're maybe even afraid to ask,
yes,
what are some of them? I mean, what are the things that people struggle to even ask and put on the table at this stage? And why do they struggle to ask?
I think for the most part, well-meaning white people don't want to appear racist because there are policies and rules and laws and regulations that say you can't say that. You can't say that. I'm also a university administrator, so there's that part of it. There's another group of people who are tired. You know, it's sort of like I'm getting to the point in my life where I'm not going to answer these stupid questions, and so don't ask me anything. you should know this. And many, because we live parallel lives in this country, that is, you could be a white upper middle class person and never have a serious conversation about race or racism with anybody in your group who is a person of color. That is the kind of world we live in. And so what we want to do is to equip the next generation of young people to be able to have those conversations because of our demographic shifts, because of our role in the world. If we're not able to have those conversations, then the U.S. will not be the U.S. of the 21st century that it could be. So it's an imperative for me.
Because there is going to be very soon no such thing as a majority of anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's the other interesting thing to add on to what you said before about the middle class. They don't need to if they don't want to engage in those conversations. They don't have to. They don't need to. So there's no reason that a person who likes to challenge themselves would try it. Somebody who doesn't, I'm in my comfort zone. I've always been in my comfort zone. I don't need to leave my comfort zone. Won't. And it'll be interesting to see where their kids go from there, because there is that, sort of inquiry to, I don't understand why we don't have different, people that come over to the house, or why we can't, and you're seeing it a lot in schools where they talk a little bit more more about culture. And I know there are some students that went to the exhibit and at a young age, because there's this understanding of if you can get them sort of early enough and their parents are comfortable with the discussion, they can sort of learn differently than how their parents were taught, and their parents don't have to go to that uncomfortable zone or not address it at all, which is worse.
Yeah. Your point is so well taken, because the research is very clear that students who are exposed to different people, different perspectives, different points of view, are better critical thinkers. It makes them better critical thinkers. So not only is it good for the students of color, it's good for all students.
Yeah.
And that's the point. It makes us better people. And these are the people that are going to be the leaders when we have to pass the baton over. Mm-hmm. And they will be able to talk about these tough issues that our generation and our parents were not able to or could not. Mm-hmm. Because this is their country. Yeah. This is the leadership roles they're going to have to play in the workplace, in the institutions. There is no place you're going to be able to go and have any kind of responsible role and not have to deal with difference.
No.
263-WXXI is our number, 1370 Connection, the program you're listening to at WXXI AM 1370. I'm Bob Smith with Tariq Spence, and we are welcoming Yolanda Moses, who is anthropologist and associate chancellor of the University of California at Riverside and a creative mind behind the exhibit Race, Are We So Different? The latest stop in its tour across the country is the Rochester Museum and Science Center. An important question to ask these days. You're entitled to ask it, and you will get an authoritative answer if you go to the exhibit and listen to our guest this hour. She'll be speaking this evening, by the way, at 7:30 at the Eisenhardt Auditorium at the museum campus. Let's go to Rich on the line right now. And hi, Rich, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing today?
We're doing okay, Hanks. How are you?
Okay. Hey, this is a really interesting conversation, and I find that in my travels, number one, the isms are everywhere, and I go from I go to Canada a lot, and they look at things differently, but isms are still there. The racism still exists. I find when you travel to South America, racism is a very strong thing, strong in the sense of color in South America, and you find in Europe it's strong in the sense of. It seems like Western Europe, any place that seems to have a strong Western Europe influence, racism based on color is a very strong thing. But another thing I know I have to say is that in our conversation, there has to be a willingness to dialogue and to explain yourself. So many people, as a black American, I go around a lot of circles that I'm around a lot of white Americans. A lot of times they just don't know. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a problem with explaining it very succinctly and very clearly and handling questions, because people do have questions. You cannot always assume because people don't know something it's because they don't want to know something or because they're racist. There are a lot of people who you go into a lot of towns, especially in Western New York, who there might be less than 1% black or 1% Hispanic in the town. And people just don't know. And both sides have to acknowledge that and talk about it.
Good point.
I think he raises a fantastic point, especially when I went to college, the same exact thing. It was new for me as a kid who grew up in New York City to go to Rockport, which is a totally, you know, totally different environment. But it was an environment that I was able to sort of adapt to. But there were other kids who couldn't adapt to this new understanding of seeing African Americans for the first time that weren't on television, you know, doing whatever. But that is his point. It's very clear in the sense that when somebody sees you, this may be the first time they've ever seen somebody of a different culture or a different race or whatever it may be. And whatever perception they were told beforehand will come to a head at that particular moment. And I think he's right. You have to have those sort of conversations and not get so quick to be angry mm-hmm. about the question, because you don't realize how much of an impression you're making. I can't tell you how many times I've run into people who are fresh from college and just say, "Oh, it was a great experience." And they hesitate for a second because they're not sure if they should tell me. It's like, you know, I've never been around people from New York City before or different cultures before, and they feel more comfortable talking about it because it's probably never been talked about before.
Right.
And if it has, it may not have been in such a comfortable environment for them to feel as if, you know what, I don't like the words being chosen here, and I know they're not very positive.
Right.
Well, you know, Richard, I'm kind of curious about something. When you talk about which kinds of things that people ask you on this, what are they asking you?
Well, they'll ask me things like why do black people do this, or why does it seem like this happens in your group and in your ethnic group? And I start explaining to them a lot of it is ethnic. It's not as much color as ethnicity. I also explain to them, I will even start from the point of explaining to them why I'm the way I am, you know, and I think it's a very, very common thing for black males, especially, and Tariq probably could speak to this. We are taught from a young age to make white people comfortable with our presence.
Yep.
You have to do that. That's the first and foremost thing you must do when you walk into a room of white people who don't know you. Especially as a black male, you have to make them comfortable and make them feel safe that I'm not going to do anything. And I use that as a breakup point to explain to them how insidious thinking and racism is. So when they ask me those questions, I say to them, because of that question, I have to do this, because I know that you're asking, you have that thought in your mind, or why, you know. So it is so deep, and it's so ingrained in our culture and in every way. And I even see it as a black person. One of my greatest questions and challenges is to how to root out the anger and the hurt in the black community itself that is so rooted so deeply.
That's profoundly sad. If you don't mind my saying so, it seems. It's profoundly sad to hear that.
But let me tell you what I have seen. This is exhibit has been to about 50 cities now, and we've gotten some anecdotal feedback. And what I have heard from African Americans is that it's so empowering for them, because they can be in the exhibit and they can see all the things that they have wanted to say to people and have said to people that have not been heard. Being on display in the exhibit, and it allows them to be able to dialogue with people about things that they were not able to actually get the point across. But because it's in an exhibit, and because it is public, and because it is in a museum, it has cachet.
There's a great freedom of understanding. Remember, we had a discussion, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, about racism being this mythical thing that nobody seems to want to believe until they actually see it. And you know, African Americans have been sort of talking about this for years, and it's sort of been pushed to the side as, no, you know, that's not right, or no, you know, don't read into it too much, or what. And this exhibit basically says, no, this is the way it has gone. This is the way it has been. And I think that, you know, to his point of young people, the best thing that has worked for me is respect. When you walk into a room, you have to respect the people that are in the room, and hopefully they respect you. And until until they don't, then you can leave the room. But but that's the one thing that it was always in talk. But he's absolutely right. You have to understand that, you know, there are different cultures, there are different things. But when I was younger, I was sort of taught that, understand, speak up. You have to speak for yourself. You know, don't come in a threatening tone. Explain what you have to do. Do it softly. You know, and these are the things. He's absolutely right. I can remember thinking about that going to school. The exact same things that I was told, but I was also told you have to speak up for yourself. You have to understand, you know, you can't, you know, you can't always take it lying down. There are times to walk away and there are times to fight. So it's very, very artistic in the way you have to deal with certain things.
And we wanted to pitch this exhibit not as a guilt trip for anybody. This is educational materials that will give people the ability to understand what it is they're talking about from a historical, from a scientific, and from a contemporary perspective. That was what we were aiming for. So, and we talked a lot about how to do that so that we could walk that line.
Mm-hmm. And just to interject real quick, Bob, you made the comment how sad it is.
Yes.
At this point in my life, I don't have time to think about if it's sad. It is the reality of it. And for me, with as a person, and I think Tariq and I know each other personally, if I'm not... Could be.
I can't remember you off the top of the head, but we could know each other. But our experiences are the same, so yeah. I feel like I know you.
Tariq, just think of Uncle.
You
know exactly who I am.
Okay, all right. I got you.
But the thing is that as a man with children, and as a man who may become a grandfather, and as a black man who sees what's happening in the black community, I don't have time to be sad anymore or angry. Yeah. I want to be able to teach people how to deal with this on both ends. Because until it's done on both ends, until the establishment realizes the reality of it, and until the minorities realize, yes, it is real, but we don't have to come to it, and we don't have to let it dominate our every living breath, then it doesn't change. But there's got to be on both sides. There has to be a real understanding of the reality of it.
Can I follow up? one of the other aha moments in our exhibit is the part of the exhibit that is focused on the creation of whiteness and white privilege. And what we wanted to do was to unpack that. So not only would people of color who come through say, okay, that's good, you did that, but white people will say, oh, and we've got a lot of that. Why is this here? And so it gives the opportunity to talk about how that racial hierarchy was created and who has been at the top of it and how institutions have to change, not just how individuals relate to each other in order for it to be different.
And Rich, thank you very much for sharing that with us. We appreciate the call. We do have to take a short break, but we will be back with more. I'm Bob Smith with Tariq Spence, and we are talking with Professor Yolanda Moses of the University of California at Riverside, anthropologist, associate university chancellor, and one of the creative forces behind the exhibit Race, Are We So Different? That is now underway at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. And a reminder, Professor Moses will be speaking this evening at 7:30 at the Eisenhart Auditorium at the museum campus. And we are talking with her right now on 1370 Connection. Back in a minute on WXXI AM 1370. We'll be right back. 1370 Connection continues on WXXIM 1370 with Tariq Spence. I'm Bob Smith. We're talking with Professor Yolanda Moses of the University of California at Riverside. She is an anthropologist, associate university chancellor, and the creative force behind the exhibit Race, Are We So Different? That is causing so much conversation and so much revelation in a lot of people's minds at the Rochester Museum and Science Center right now. Dial 263-WXXI, 263-9994 to learn more. And let's take a call from John right now. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Hey, Bob. Hey, Professor.
Hi.
Professor, you know, I know a lot of whites that voted for Barack Obama in the last election.
Uh-huh.
And it almost was like they looked at Romney as whiter than white, lame, milquetoast, and square. And I think the media, in a way, presented Romney that way. And President Obama was cool. And, you know, and African-American. And I thought that was kind of ironic and maybe a good sign for things changing in this country. The other thing was Herman Cain, when he ran for the nomination, the Republican nomination, a number of black Americans, African-Americans, friends of mine, mocked Herman Cain, mm-hmm. called him Uncle Tom, et cetera. It was almost like a reverse racism. What are your thoughts on both points?
Let me start with Herman Cain and the reverse racism. It's very interesting that the party of Lincoln, the Republican Party, has become in the minds of African Americans, particularly in the South, a different kind of party. And they were Republican, and then there were the Dixiecrats, and now the Republican Party is a party that is not been as coalition building, let's say, as the Democrats, that had over time built a class base, a race ethnic base, and a gender base. And you've seen it in the last three elections. So Herman Cain might have been African American, but Herman Cain's politics and Herman Cain's position was of a conservative. And that is not something, obviously, that most African Americans who vote for. So again, it's not about skin color as much as it is about the political affiliation. I think that there are some sweeping demographic shifts that are happening in this country. And in 2008, people said it was a fluke, perhaps, that Barack Obama got in because of how bad most people thought Bush was as a president. But 2012 showed that it was not a fluke. And there is a groundswell of people who believe in middle-of-the-road politics, who are women, who are young people, who are educated people. And given a choice between someone who's talking about progress and change and someone who has been on tape talking about takers and 47% and not really presenting themselves as one of the people, they had a choice, and I think they made it.
Hey, Andrew, thank you very much for calling. Of course, it's interesting the degree to which I think, especially in 2012, a lot of people basically just looked at it nuts and bolts and dollars and cents when they voted. They basically voted with their wallets more than anything else and decided that one candidate would fill up their wallets more effectively than the other guy did.
And it basically showed a lot of how we view who the leader of this country is going to be and how well they relate to us. There's this feeling that sort of Romney was, given this fortune and built this fortune and then sort of lost touch with, you know, the working everyday person. And President Obama, who had been in the White House for 4 years, still had that sort of feeling of work every day, very little vacation, went to Ivy League school, worked his way up from Ivy League school, went to, you know, career in politics, worked his way through that. And there's a sense that America sort of saw that in him. And made that decision for two terms. And I think what happens is how well do you relate to the people who are voting for you? And two, a lot of the political discussions, immigration and the different discussions on how we feel about abortion and religion and different. It's sort of, you've got to be willing to at least bring those conversations to the table like you would race. There are a lot of those conversations. Race is just one of the many conversations this exhibit is willing to talk about.
Right.
But there are about five or six other major swinging points that this country will not budge on. And that is what is now determining who runs this country going forward.
And of course, what he succeeded in doing was essentially charting the center course.
Right.
And making everybody feel more comfortable with the way things are going or the way he planned to make them go. That's not necessarily a retrospective endorsement or anything
that.
Everybody's free to make their own decision, but obviously a majority of Americans made their decision.
Yeah.
Both popular vote and electoral vote.
Exactly. So we have the people's choice there. And I guess at this point, there will be those who say, as a result of that simple salient fact, well, are we getting closer to the point where race doesn't matter and we just look analytically at who's going to take us in the direction we want to go?
No. we have not reached that point. And it's very clear that there are other things also that happened when Obama became president. For example, Southern Poverty Law Center reports the highest number of hate crimes in America during his presidency, and it keeps going up and up and up, and they have to do with crimes around race and immigration issues of racialized people. There's still structural poverty. There's still achievement gap. There's still health disparities based on race. So until some of these structural issues are dealt with, I would say that one African-American male in the White House is a symbol, but it is not getting at that structural inequality that we have to continue to work on.
Are we trapped in a paradox, or is it just that we need to look to a more aggressive attempt to address a lot of these issues from our future leaders beyond 2016?
I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where we'll all agree. That's a great little world that we may not see in our lifetime. But it is the willingness to have these discussions, the willingness to at least walk into the room and hear me out, and not be sort of pushed by the ultimate party agenda or whatever it may be. Hear my side. I will hear your side. We will get everything out on the table and discuss it. That's what I think a lot of people are looking for their politicians. But there are things that just get in the way with it, and race and not willing to have these different discussions is one of them.
And race and intersections with class and other kinds of issues. And, to make another point, on our website is a little vignette of a girl who repeated the doll test that was done as one of the deciding factors in the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education. That is, at that time in the 50s, when black children were given black dolls and white dolls, they chose white dolls over black dolls because they said that they were better, they were prettier, they were nicer. And this was done in 2007, and the children were from public schools, and the doll test was repeated, and the very same thing happened.
The same thing?
Yep.
Yes.
You would have expected that by now the kids would just pick whatever doll looks most like them.
You would think so. The other point is that on CNN there's a program, and I think you could probably download it from Soledad O'Brien, who did on Being Black in America, and she focused on school kids, and there were middle-class black parents that did not know how their own children felt about being black because they didn't talk negatively about it at home, but it was happening in their schools and in other places. And when they were interviewed separately from their parents, it was like the parents were in shock that this was going on.
Yeah.
263 WXXI, we have Susan on the line. Hi, Susan, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm 63 years old. And I wasn't raised right around here. But when I was a kid, I knew what racism meant. It meant that you thought that people of whatever ethnicity, including Jewish, I was raised in a Jewish, mostly Jewish town right after the Holocaust, and that racism meant you thought that people of another ethnicity had a hereditary defect. Now, it doesn't seem to mean that, and that to me is emblemized by the way Spanish people use that word in terms of Spanish people who are not the same race, and everybody that speaks Spanish isn't a race. Spanish is a language. And when the Grammys a little while ago got rid of Latin jazz, this musician called it racist to do that. Emery, I thought that was a confusing way to use the term. The Grammys they look like they give awards to people who aren't white, mm-hmm. and it looked like they were just getting rid of smaller categories like the polka and all that stuff.
There could have been some cultural bias.
How is that word being used? And I asked that at a meeting I was at where it was about race, and they said they didn't know. And I'm just curious, like, now what does the word mean? Racism.
Yeah, that's a good question, Susan. Thanks for asking it, and I'm glad we have an anthropologist here right now, because Dr. Moses, you're going to be able to help us out a lot with that. Under what circumstances do we distinguish race from culture, from ethnicity, and all of these other things? And is there a good definition that's actually going to give us some real understanding and knowledge of it?
Well, there are some principles, and we raise these principles in our exhibit. But one of the things we wanted to show with the exhibit going back to 1790 in this country is that the concept of race has been very fluid, that it shifts and it changes depending on the social, economic, and political landscape. So there were people raced in, and we've been doing the census since 1780, 90. So if you go back and look at the census all the way forward, people are categorized in different categories depending on social, economic, and political times. And one of the ways we show this in the exhibit is to have the people wear T-shirts in three different censuses, what they would have been called. We also have timelines and what have you that kind of contextualizes why they were called that. And it has to do with, again, immigration policies. It has to do with the law. For example, Chinese and Latinos are considered white by law. But over the years, when they would bring lawsuits, they would say, yes, well, you are sort of white, but not really white. And so the law has colluded with this as well. And we wanted to point out the fact that no wonder society is confused, because it has been a fluid concept that's been picked up and used when it helped to maintain the racial hierarchy. That's the best way for me to explain it. And so the census will tell you, the Bureau, that these categories are not scientific. So as scientists, we say, well, then why do you use them? And they say, because we have a mandate to right social wrongs in the past, and so we use these categories to keep track of how well we're doing. Well, I don't buy that, but, you know, that's what they say. So to the caller, I think a contextualized definition is really important to understand. And any time racism in a social context means the ability to that you do something or you take an action that is based on the other person's skin color, in this case, or racial identity. But the reality is race is not just about skin color. It's about class position. It's about language. In this country, it's about class position. It's about language. It's about status as a citizen. All of these things stand in for race now.
1370 Connection continuing at WXXI. Bob Smith, Tariq Spitz. co-hosting this segment and talking with Professor Yolanda Moses of the University of California at Riverside, anthropologist, associate chancellor of the university, and one of the key figures in putting together the exhibit, Race, Are We So Different?, that is really helping generate a dialogue on race here in the Rochester metropolitan area as it continues its run at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. She'll be speaking this evening at 7:30 at the Eisenhart Auditorium as part of the Science on the Edge lecture series at the Rochester Museum. Let's go to the phones again at 263-WXXI, and we have Andrew.
Good afternoon. Hi, Dr. Moses.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
So the goal is still to get beyond race, right?
The goal is to understand race and then to decide what is real about it and what isn't and how to change the way we talk about it, yes.
Okay. I mean, because I read the Bible a lot, and there's no mention of race in the scriptures, not really, you know. I mean, there might be one verse in all 66 books that talks about the color of some guy's skin or something. But, not. I mean, and it seems to me that it would be good to get beyond race and you're just a guy and I'm just a guy and Bob's just a guy and Tariqa's just a guy. You know what I mean?
Ideally.
Yeah.
But that's not how we're structured right now. And I think in order to get beyond something, you need to understand what that something is so that you know what levers to use to get beyond it.
Yeah. I went to the race initiative meeting at that big church about a month ago.
Okay.
And we had a lot of interesting discussions. And I was trying to, you know, basically say to people what I just said to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I got pretty much the same reaction. You know, ideally, that's where we want to be.
I don't know if we truly believe, and I think this is something maybe we should change our mindset on, that we can get there within our lifetime. I think we just hope that we can at least bring up the discussion and that the next generation will take it from there and then the next generation will take it from there. I think the interesting point that you made about the Bible and religion, there are so many different things that we are so common on when it comes to our religious beliefs, you know, whether it be Christianity, and yet our churches are segregated. So it's almost as if we still – no, I'm being serious.
Yeah.
There's so many different things that, you know, we went to – my son we're in a church one day, and so he went to a preschool that's very religious. And you know, he points out, he's like, John 3:16. And so we were in a different school. And so he sort of understood. I'm like, wow, everybody knows what John 3:16 is. And so so it was for him, you know, an understanding of there are common bonds, yet we still have this issue of maybe not going to the same church together, maybe not understanding, you know, supporting the same team together. It's always these common things that we have that we teach in our culture, but we don't. For some strange reason, when we get together, we don't even bring it up.
Not all churches are like that.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm not saying all churches are. I'm just saying that, you know, a lot of them are.
Yes. And you're right.
And many churches have been involved with the change. If you think about the civil rights movement, if you think about the engagement of churches in the whole immigration issue and citizenship. But we also make the point that churches were part of the problem in our U.S. history, because those verses in the Bible that talked about Cain and Abel and it talked about, you know, differences in people, perhaps not race, were interpreted to mean there shall be a hierarchy and that people, that slaves were, and Native Americans were going to be on the bottom of that, as so ordained by this scripture or that scripture. So religion was enlisted to reinforce that system the same way science was. So it was a collusion that we talked about. So again, understanding that helps us to move forward and not just to see, you know, religion as a panacea for change.
Right. There's a lot of slavery in the Bible.
Mm. Yes.
Even in the New Testament.
Yes. But American U.S. slavery is different than any other slavery in the world.
Oh, sure, yeah. It was sort of almost more employment in some of the slavery in the Bible.
I mean, yeah, there are different kinds of slave systems.
Yeah, and then there was always the ultimate imperative, let my people go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Which happened from time to time in the Bible. Right?
Yeah. So where do you see the country now, Dr. Moses? I mean, do you see it as moving forward or backwards?
Well, it depends on the country. This country is made up of a lot of different parts, and I think there are also some regional imperatives. I think the fact that the president has decided that he's going to take on the immigration issue means that as a country, we're going to do something about it. I think where I come from in the Southwest in California is a minority-majority state. And so it is in our economic, social, and political interest to make sure that every single citizen has the opportunity to be successful, or we're not going to be successful as a state. And I know that everybody's not there, but what I'm saying is there are some imperatives that we need to look at. This is not just a social justice issue. This is a democratic imperative for our nation to do this, and it is also an economic and competitive reason to do it. So for all of those reasons, I think you're going to see some movement on some fronts, but not necessarily all. And this project was designed, and I keep saying this, for young people and to train teachers on how to educate the next generation of young people about how to be in the world with each other.
Hey, Andrew, I thank you very much. We're going to try to get at least one more call in. I don't think we can do justice to it, though. And that is unfortunate because there's so much more to say, so much more to discuss, a topic that's really deep, complex, and deserves a lot more hours than we have time to give it today. I have time right now to only say thanks to our guest of the hour, Dr. Yolanda Moses, anthropologist and associate chancellor of the University of California at Riverside, will be speaking this evening at 7:30 at Eisenhower Auditorium about Race, Are We So Different?, an exhibition which she has played a singular part in helping to create. Dr. Moses, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And our thanks as well to our co-host, Tariq Spence of WDKX, for contributing so much to this whole series of programs. Tariq, great having you on board and being our partner.
Always great to be here, Bob. Thank you.
And thank you all for being with us here on 1370 Connection from WXXI AM and FM HD2 Rochester. For Dave Kemp, our technical director, and for Tariq Spence, my co-host and partner, I'm Bob Smith. It's been a pleasure.